Hello there. How are you guys? It's amazing here at Breakfast All Day that all four of us are here 2 weeks in a row.
I know. It's crazy.
It's unprecedented.
We all got to the table last week. I mean, I don't think even like when we had What the Flick, I don't think all four of us were here at the same time ever 2 weeks in a row.
No, I'm sure that it happened.
It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Anyway, hello and welcome to Breakfast All Day. I'm Christy.
I'm Alonzo.
Who are you?
I'm sorry. I'm Ben. I didn't realize what was happening.
It's Masketeer roll call. Yeah. Come on. I'm going to do a quick little Lego Movie 2 review. These folks have not had the pleasure of seeing it.
Someone didn't send me the screening info.
I just feel like you're a grown-up, Matt, and you can arrange your own screenings.
Sometimes
at this point.
I don't hear about things and rely on my critic friends to tell me.
I don't like movies about toys.
These are wisecracking, self-referential meta toys. So Matt and somebody else at this table, Alonzo.
Yes.
What? Maybe Ben. You guys will catch up with it. We'll come back to it again next week as well. But I wanted to do a quick little hit on Lego Movie 2. It is Lego Movie 2, the second part. And it would be impossible to recreate the magic of the original Lego Movie. It was so innovative visually, narratively. You know, I thought it was profound. I gave it 4 stars. I laughed. I cried. I cried at the Lego Movie, as you guys may well be aware.
I got choked up at the end of it, too.
I talk about. Yep. Right. And so, hold on. We're noisy. So nothing could be that good, right? Because the novelty is gone. Plus, it begins with the assumption that the profound twist at the end that changed everything.
The thing I didn't like about the original Lego
Movie. Right. It's been 5 years and everyone's seen it, so it's not a shocker that it's all actually like live action, you know.
I haven't seen either one. I am certain that if I had seen the first Lego Movie, it is inconceivable that I would recall the twist at the end.
The twist is that it's all happening in real life. That like the Lego Movie action, all the adventures are the manifestation of the little boy playing in his basement and reacting to his dad, played by Will Ferrell, who doesn't want the Lego set to be messed up.
I'm sure whether it's good or bad, I am certain that I'd be like, I know I would be saying right now, how do you remember that?
Because
you've seen 1,700 movies since then.
This stuck with me. Anyway, so this one begins right at the end of that first movie. And then zaps forward 5 years, and we go back and forth this time in between the animation and the real life in this house with the boy who is still played by the same kid, Jaden Sand, and his little sister who is now older, played by Brooklyn Prince from the Florida Project, a little girl from Florida Project. And it's sort of like a Mad Max Fury Road apocalypse type situation because the two of them are fighting so much over their toys, which is, you know, revealed as the toys all in misery. The Duplo space blocks that we saw at the end of the first Lego Movie have now invaded and abducted Emmett, who is Chris Pratt, and Lucy, played by Elizabeth Banks, and Lego Batman, who's Will Arnett, and Unikitty, who is Allison Brie. Like, they're all there. And the queen of the Sistar system is Tiffany Haddish. So she's a very welcome addition to the cast. And basically, it's how everyone kind of learns to get along in Legoland now that they are older and they are trying to share toys. It is still a ton of fun. It is high energy. It is a million pop culture references and more songs. It's more of a musical than the original was. The song you guys heard at the beginning of this show, if you're listening to the podcast, that song will do as advertised. It will get stuck inside your head. It is this movie's Everything is Awesome. But there are more and more songs than that. There's a great song that's all about the various incarnations of Batman. Yeah. Will Arnett and Tiffany Haddish sing a whole song about, like, it's very, very pop culture heavy. Okay. All of the various Batmans. And then stay through the credits because there's an amazing...
Batmans or Batmen?
It's Batsmen, I believe, like attorneys general.
Batsmen.
Chiefs of staff.
Okay.
But stay through all of the credits because the credit song is amazing. I had a really good time. Nick had a really good time. We both loved the first one so much. But there's just something there. There's like...
I'm sure I would have loved
a loss of novelty. Phil Lord and Christopher Miller just wrote the script this time. They didn't write and direct. Mm-hmm. So it's got like their snappy, fast-paced dialogue. A guy named Mike Mitchell who did Trolls, which I know you loved, Alonzo. Same director who did that and Shrek Ever After. He directs this. And there's a bit of a slackness to the pacing here and there. There's one bit involving a Lego banana peel that keeps tripping over itself, which is not really all that funny the first time, and they keep going back to that bit over and over and over again. So it is not as consistently clever, innovative, hilarious, but still a lot of fun. I had a good time.
Better or worse than Lego Batman movie?
Oh, I think it's better than Lego Batman. Because the thing with Lego Batman for me is that, like...
That's my favorite.
Really? A little bit of Lego Batman goes a long way for me. Like, little small sporadic doses of Will Arnett doing that character.
Yeah, but Harvard for police. Come on.
No, there's a lot that's clever in that. And but I think I might like this better. But but they're all sort of a piece in that. Nothing can compare with the original. Like, what was so fresh and so exciting then just simply cannot be duplicated.
Can a five-year-old see it?
Absolutely.
Because as soon as you said the joke that doesn't work, like, I'm already like, you know, my daughter, she loves when people fall down.
Right.
So I just figure that.
So you walk around town knocking people over.
That's right.
Because yeah. You're a good dad.
Yeah. No, it's, no, and again, the first one worked for all ages. This one does too. I mean, little kids won't get all of the pop culture references, you know.
But they won't get scared.
Oh, no, there isn't anything scary about it. Yeah. It's. No, yeah, it does not have
the
emotional.
It's not the scary Lego movie.
No, but it also doesn't have, like there's an emotional heft to the original Lego movie that is missing here. Like, it's still.
This girl was terrified during Up. Terrified. Crying. Unconsolable.
I cried unconsolably during Up.
No, she didn't cry from fear. She cried from terror.
Listen, those dogs are scary.
I was pregnant when I saw Up. I was a mess. I had all kinds of hormones going on. So anyway, I really liked it. I'm giving it an 8. I look forward to seeing what you guys think. We'll come back to it and do a little quickie next week and talk about it. But it is the big movie of the week, so we didn't want to let the week go by without talking about it. And we play all there's a bunch of songs that are great. We play them all in my car, like, nonstop. I blast them in my car coming to pick up my kid from school just to be the embarrassing mom.
Perfect.
There you go.
Mission accomplished.
So we've got to talk about a movie. We've got to talk about the behind the scenes stuff with the movie that has happened since the movie came out. And that movie is Cold Pursuit. It is your annual Liam Neesoning.
Biannual.
Is it every 2 years?
Yeah, it feels like every year.
Okay. But, Ben.
I think you meant semi-annual, like we get 2 a year.
Oh, how great would that be?
What's biennial? Is when they
it's
do
every 2 years.
Mattress
every
sales. 2 years. Anyway, Ben, will you tell us about Cold Pursuit, please?
Oh, sure. I wasn't expecting to, but Cold Pursuit is the story of Liam Neeson. He has the greatest snowblower in the world. He's also
the greatest name, Nils Kotsman.
Nils Kotsman.
Well, yeah. Because in the original Norwegian film that it was based on, he was Nils Dickman.
Dickman.
Is that right?
Yeah. This is based on a film called In Order of Disappearance that came out in 2014.
Right. Same director.
Yeah, Dickman
cousin
and Kotsman.
Cousin of Mike Duffman.
And he lives in he lives sort of above a resort town in Colorado, a ski escape town for wealthy folks. But there are there are regular folks who live in the town, and he clears the roads during the snow. He clears the one main road to enable people to get around town and get to Denver. Apparently, it's weird. There's only one small two-lane highway that leads to Denver. You'd think Denver would have many more access routes, but apparently not. And he lives there with his wife, Laura Dern, and his son. And then a tragedy befells the family, and because it's a Liam Neeson movie released in January or February, then he seeks revenge.
Are you saying his son is taken?
Again.
Again?
That's right.
And he goes on a nonstop crusade?
He has a particular set of skills, in addition to snow blowing. And the movie is that story, and then it's much more than that story. And in the end, it feels like a Coen Brothers movie that they turned down. There's a great deal of violence and a great deal of death. And it is not just in any way Liam Neeson's story of hunting down who has wronged his family. It becomes something much more that occasionally works and sometimes doesn't, but is certainly not the movie I think any of us expected.
Yeah, at some point this movie kind of abandons Kotsman as a character, and you're kind of when it comes back to him, you're like, oh, right. This is the guy that started
that's right.
All this.
This is a Liam Neeson movie, but it's been 32 minutes since we got a lot of Liam Neeson.
Usually these Liam Neeson movies are like all Liam Neeson all the time, and this one starts expanding outward, and you start getting to know like the drug mob and then the other rival drug mob and the local cops and the, so there's like all these characters sort of jockeying for position, and you're right, in a very Coen Brothers way, it's trying to be funny at the same time, and the funny stuff is funny, and the violent stuff is violent, but the two don't ever really mesh in a satisfying way, at least not for me.
And the funny stuff isn't always funny.
No,
and
no,
I'm curious whether you guys, how you feel about
some
this.
Of it is, I think.
No question. It's not unfunny, yeah. But some of it is, and oddly, this has nothing to do with the issues surrounding the movie, which we will also discuss, but some of it to me, and I don't find myself a particularly sensitive person, some of it felt racist. Like, it just, or you know, again, the words that we're being told now not to use, but certainly racially reckless.
Well, they're definitely, I thought they were sort of playing around with the idea of what you can and can't say. There's the rival drug mob is Native American. They're all indigenous peoples. And, for example, there is one single member of that that organization who is South Asian. So, of course, the other people in that group refer to him as the fucking Indian.
Right,
which
right.
I thought was funny. That's a ballsy joke.
That's,
you know,
a ballsy joke.
Right, the reservation joke was pretty funny.
But having, there's a wife of one of the characters is I guess, Vietnamese.
She's
doing her nails, and she's talking in a very stereotypically Vietnamese way. There's a joke about the dialect of a black hitman that, again, is supposed to be funny. And I get that the point of the joke is supposed to...
Or the Eskimo.
We're supposed to make fun of the guy pointing out the dialect, but it just... It didn't... I thought it was weirdly uncomfortable and unnecessary and did not deliver the laugh.
It doesn't all land, and I don't know if it's because the director is a foreigner and maybe doesn't quite get the niceties of race relations in the United States, but no, I you're right. There are some of them that definitely don't work. And also, I think the movie gets so overcrowded that, like, Laura Dern disappears after having had nothing to do.
It's a total waste of Laura Dern. Yeah. So did any of you guys see the original Norwegian film this was based on?
I know.
Okay. Evidenced by our reaction I didn't even know it was.
Yeah. No,
I don't watch
it. Yes, I saw it. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. So the same director did both. And so often when directors of, you know, a foreign language film then try to remake their own film in English, like, as you say, Alonzo, something does get lost in the translation, and there's a lot of the bits fall flat. In the original, it was this kind of really dark humor, like pitch black, like dry, dark humor, and it worked that first time around. And here, it's just the pacing just feels kind of flat to me. I mean, there should be like highs and lows in a film that is this dramatic and which so many lives are lost in really brutal ways. And it all felt kind of like one note to me. And again, like Liam Neeson has made so many films of this ilk and so many that are so much better that it's impossible not to watch this and compare it to those movies as well. Because you know what he can do with that particular set of skills, as you said.
And when somebody goes through a snowplow, it's like, well, if we weren't already thinking about Fargo, I am now.
Yeah, it's the wood chipper.
But like in Fargo, for example, and in Fargo, the television show too, and the dark humor surrounding the brutal violence, does not have a giant emotional kick to it, which I think sometimes, I'm not saying it's that the deaths are worthless or that they don't mean something, but here there is at least one death that it's awful and it's terrible and you're grieving, and then the sort of fun part about the deaths, and they do a little fun gimmick about each character who dies, it doesn't feel fun because you're thinking, you've made me like a couple of people who are now in horrible mourning and their lives will never again be the same.
It gets caught in your throat
and I don't want the your little fun death joke I'm not digging it here. And
also,
Fargo manages to thread that needle effectively, and this did not.
If I recall, because I've seen a lot of movies in the last 2 weeks, there's a thing with a dog here. Is there a thing with a dog here, or am I thinking of something else that I saw?
I think you're thinking of something else.
Okay, anyway, I recall seeing a thing with a dog where I'm like, you just lost me. But there are other deaths here that do not work. I agree. And the thing with the gimmick with how they depict each person's death, they do that in the original, too.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
With the title cards explaining who they all are.
That could definitely work. And then finally when they kill a Jewish guy, we didn't know he was Jewish, they'd had crosses, all of a sudden there's a Star of David. That could be fun. By the way, one other quick little joke that doesn't work, there's a not a, not a conceptually unfunny idea of a guy who manages to sleep with 31% of all the hotel maids that he encounters, motel maids.
Oh, right.
But then the execution of, it's not great, but then the execution of that joke is that, oh, ha ha, this one's older and uglier. And now, whatever. It just,
it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it was like the third sort of racially adjacent joke that didn't work. And it just struck me that these are falling short. Except for the Native Americans making fun of the fucking Asian.
Yes. So what are your numbers then? Or is there something else you want to say,
Well,
Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that there were moments of this movie that it does approach what the Coen brothers can do tonally. And there's some moments of dialogue that made me think of, like, Elmore Leonard.
Yeah.
That some of the discussions that the guys had about their lives.
Sure.
Like, because in a lot of cases, these characters, they get fleshed out in a real way. Almost more so than Coxman does.
Well, yeah, Tom Bateman as the sort of head of the main sort of drug family is, that's a funny, interesting, eccentric performance.
The Denver druggie.
Right. Yes.
Who's in a custody battle with his ex-wife for their son.
Right, yeah. And then like the stuff with the cops and the way Emmy Rossum is kind of flirting with the guy to get the stuff from him. And the cop
stuff was pretty good. I was more interested in him. I thought it would be about the cops sort of tracking down, trying to stop Liam Neeson from exacting revenge, but sort of admiring him at the same time. And I thought that movie probably would have been better.
Yeah, there are a lot of elements that work, and I wasn't bored.
I was bored.
It just doesn't quite gel.
So I forgot, before we do numbers, we got to talk really fast about what is happening in real life behind the scenes with this movie, which it in no way, you know, influences our feelings about the film, because what we have learned is...
I wrote my review weeks ago.
So... Liam Neeson did this interview with The Guardian?
The Independent.
And he acknowledged, while sitting next to his co-star, Tom Bateman, that many, many years ago, he was so enraged by learning about a friend's rape that
I thought a family member.
But he wanted to go and exact revenge, and so he only knew that this person was described as a black man, and so he went out in the streets looking for a black man to kill.
Like with a baseball bat.
With a kosh, as he put it, a bludgeon.
Or in Ireland, the shillelagh.
Yes. So this happened decades ago. And he says in this interview that
it was
blackface, right? It was fine. I don't know why that's come out now, but he felt the need to say this now. And he acknowledges in this interview that he had never spoken about this before. And there has been, understandably, massive backlash to this, to the extent that, like, was it last night, two nights ago, they were supposed to have had the red carpet premiere film?
They had the premiere, but they canceled the red carpet part because he didn't want to answer more
questions. And now there's people like, oh, he should get digitized out of Men in Black. And
what do you guys think of this?
I think he said something really stupid.
He said something really stupid. And it is that thing of like, this is why people have publicists. You know, like, this is why you don't say everything on your mind into a mic, you know.
Yeah. We do. We don't have a movie coming out.
Oh, you have no idea.
Also, I haven't walked around looking for black people to beat up.
It's the kind of story that you know, if you felt the need to say it, needed to be written about and put in as much context as you could in your memoir. But, you know, I'm of two minds on it. On one sense, he correctly says, this is a humiliating part of my life, and I regret it. And thankfully, mercifully, I didn't hurt anybody. Right. But he acknowledges, like, almost because by chance I didn't run into anyone who I could hurt. I now realize how monstrous that was. All that is good. Then there is the white privilege part of it, which was that, he went out and did this and thought it was okay at the time, and he will suffer no real consequences for it. His career, I suppose, it's possible, might. But he, what it leaves out is that it's not just one guy who went out looking to do this. Thousands and thousands and thousands of guys went out looking to do this.
This is the course
of American history.
George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin.
And then they did it. And they lynched black people and they beat them to death or maimed them in some way. And there were no significant repercussions for centuries and decades in this country and around the world. So, that's why you don't talk about it flippantly, even though I don't think he thought it was flippantly.
Right.
And so I think there should be a degree of understanding thrown his way because he did attempt to contextualize it and admit that it was wrong, but it is it does not acknowledge the broader, bigger picture of the history of racial violence in America.
I would say memo to everybody. Do not discuss sensitive subjects on the press tour for your movie.
Like, right.
There's it's just your, like...
It becomes a tweet. It becomes a headline. Right. And you don't get all the context, as Ben was talking about, right?
Right. Like, I mean, we see that over and over again, right? Like, the context of what Bradley Cooper says gets left out about him saying, you know, oh, I feel like I didn't do my job not getting the nomination for Best Director, and then follows up with, and I realize how foolish that thought is, but nobody covers that part, right? So... You know, will Neeson continue to have her career? Probably so. I mean, Mark Wahlberg was convicted of beating the hell out of a guy, and that record's been expunged. And we've all acted like, I mean, everybody's
we know what happened, but it's, he's, you know, carried on.
And that, I believe, was also a racially motivated.
It was an Asian guy.
Right. So, you know, will Neeson get past this? You know, he's kind of doing the apology tour. Like, he went on and said, like, I think he'll probably come back. But, yeah, it was a really stupid thing to say.
And there's never a good time to say that kind of thing. But especially
well, like you said,
now.
In a memoir.
Well, you know, you can tell
your family.
What
I mean, like, on a press tour is not a good place.
No, because you don't know what the headline is going to be, but you should know what the takeaway from that is going to be. And so, yeah, I mean, I like Liam Neeson as an actor, and I love this sort of, you know, I love the rebirth at 60 that he's had. But that was dumb, and we'll only, you know, I hesitate always to say only time will tell, but I'm afraid only time will tell.
All right, so...
our numbers for the movie?
Yeah, yes, we have numbers.
Oh, right.
But there's also a number. I'm saying 5.
6.
Wait, hold on. I'm sorry, 5.4. I'm looking at the wrong column. Yeah. 5.4 for me.
6.
Yeah, I feel like to some extent most of our talk was like only the things that didn't work. I was not bored. I was sort of engaged. It just falls short of what it certainly could have been and aspired to be, 6.8.
Yeah, I'm pretty close to where Ben is, 7.
Our number's a 5. It is,
No, hold on.
That's math. Wait. Sorry, I did math with a calculator and it didn't work.
6.3.
6.3 is a lot higher than 5. Wow, math is tough. All right, that's 84% on the tomato meter. What men want, I have no idea, but there are 3 of them at the table who can tell me.
Not this movie.
Who wants to describe what men want? Matt, you want to describe it?
Sure. Taraji P. Henson plays a high-power sports attorney sports agent. And she wants to make partner at her firm. And she gets passed over, and she's really upset about it. And she goes out on her friend's bachelorette party, and they get a psychic played by Erica Badu, who is amazing in this particular role. And she takes some really weird tea and then a few other things. It goes out dancing and hits her head and then wakes up and can hear what men think. And this is a loose remake of the original film, What Women Want, that starred Mel Gibson.
From 2000.
So she figures out, maybe she can capitalize on this, and hijinks and hilarity ensues.
But do they?
Not enough hilarity.
I like this movie.
Okay.
We need to talk about that.
I thought this movie was kind of fun. I thought that Taraji P. Henson was really funny. I really would watch far more of Erica Badu doing comedy because I thought she was really hilarious. But I liked this movie. I thought that it had, you know, it was kind of breezy. It was kind of fun. Look, it's not genius, but it's far better than what I thought I was going to get. And so maybe it's that my expectations were low, but it moved along. It didn't get, you know, it didn't feel like it was 2 hours long.
Yes, it did. Oh, it kept not ending. It wants to end, and then it keeps wanting to end.
Maybe
it helps
that I had a margarita ahead of time.
Oh,
there you go. So we should just preface everything Matt just said with the fact that he was a little tipsy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a new respect for Tyler Perry after seeing what a movie that you'd think Tyler Perry made but didn't. Because, like, Adam Shankman is a worse director than Tyler Perry.
How so? Like, camera placement?
Like, just camera placement, scenes that go on too long, gags that fall flat, like, people behaving in non-recognizably human manner. Like, Tracy Morgan in this entire... Tracy Morgan.
He's supposed to be like a
Levar Ball.
I always want to
call him Tracy Jordan. That's the thing. Tracy Morgan as the dad of the basketball star that everybody's trying to sign.
He's like Levar Ball.
Yes. Does not seem like he even wants to be here. Like, he's it's beyond phoning it in. There's a big like chaotic wedding sequence toward the end where like embarrassing truths are revealed that just is just, I don't even know what's going on in that scene. It's like bizarre and cartoonish. And
yeah, Christy's so upset she's left the review.
I clearly, it just, you know, it drags. I mean, the pacing is terrible. I'm sorry, Matt. That's not a thing that you can defend this movie on. And I mean, like, I think, I mean, Taraji P. Henson is capable of being funny and can be and has a few moments where she is. And yeah, Erykah Badu, it is a surprise that she is as funny as she is. But overall, I just felt like this movie kind of flails about and. It's plot-wise, it's almost like an R-rated Hallmark Channel movie.
There's so much wacky, jaunty music that, like, overly punctuates everything. Yeah. So there's a bit with once she can hear the thoughts, there's a bit with the guy who is super hunky who lives in her building, played by Kellan Lutz, and she's been lusting after him. And, like, the way that whole scene goes down, it's so broad. Like, so much of this humor is so broad, and as if, like, the physicality of it weren't obvious enough, we then have like wacky bam tick bam 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 tick bam 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 bam.
And all the song choices are like the hip hop party CD that Entertainment Weekly sends you in 2002 when you subscribe. Like the most obvious on the nose, like Push It
and Poison
and Bills. It's like if I know all of the hip hop songs in your movie, you didn't try hard enough.
Right. And it's all 90s stuff. And like, why are we trying to like hearken to when she was at her young Randy self?
I think they're trying to make this a girls' night out movie, maybe. I don't know, for the margarita crowd.
And then the three the three women who are her best friends, like except for Wendy McClendon Covey, who is repeatedly mentioning how much she loves Jesus, they're all essentially interchangeable. Yeah. Like they get no personalities whatsoever. They are just a gaggle that you see all together at once. This is really hit and miss. And the thoughts that she can hear are like maybe 50% of the time amusing. Like they're extremely hit and miss. Like some of it's just out there stuff and some of it's really mundane things like, did I leave the coffee pot on?
Well, or, you know, some of the stuff that happened with her and Tracy Morgan's character, Joe Dalla, was like, I wish the movie actually would have explored this a little bit more because that's the one person's thoughts that it kind of doesn't matter that she can hear because they're so out there all the time. Like it is, it's the random stuff that you kind of would expect Tracy Morgan to do. So when she can hear his thoughts, they don't have any, like it gives her no insight into what he's thinking, which I thought was kind of fun. The one guy, I don't know. This movie kind of worked for me. And I guess I, again, went in with super low expectations and had the margarita ahead of time. So my recommendation is Girls Night Out, have Margarita Monday, which they reference in the movie, and then go see this and you'll be okay.
I'm just curious whether you guys ever look at IMDb ratings because, you know, they're always high. Higher. Are you saying
that the people who rate things on IMDb are high?
I've never seen a rating this low on an IMDb rating.
What is it?
It's 2.7.
Like, wow. Right, okay.
Like the worst movies ever on IMDb are like a 5.6.
But hang on, let's be clear about this. The movie has not opened yet.
I was going to say, so who's seen it?
Right, and so this is all the problem with ratings, with audience ratings.
You
on
don't have
every
to have
site
seen it.
Is that at IMDb, like, those are ratings by people who like, oh, I don't want to see Taraji P. Henson in a movie. I'm going to vote
it
down.
Yeah, it's like all the trolls that went after the female Ghostbusters.
And that happens on Fandango. It happens with the user reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. It happens on user reviews on every site.
Yeah.
And what happens when that movie opens, they will not reset. So those are all considered by these sites valid reviews.
That's outrageous. Right? Trump should do something about that.
It is. It's outrageous.
And that's true on Yelp.
I mean, what?
That's true on Amazon.
Exactly.
The thing with What Men Want is I think that there's a noble effort to try and make this a movie about a woman in a man's world. Like she is, it's not just that she's in the corporate world. She's at a sports agency. She's the only woman there. Is she also the only black person there?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, and her, you know, like raised by a single dad, played by Richard Roundtree, who's fine. And, you know, like named for Muhammad Ali. Her name is Ali. And so this, the idea that she has to sort of figure out what being in this world has done to her personality. Like, is she not a very good friend? Is she like, you know, are her relationships very much like one night stands, that kind of thing. But the movie doesn't have then any sort of interesting insights into that. And if anything, just kind of falls back on, like I said, the sort of Hallmark thing where she has to sort of learn to be like,
although, you know, I thought the Ali Boumaier joke was funny.
I didn't get it.
Oh,
come on.
It's a boxing thing. And then also, they go to the cute kid too much.
Oh, and he's terrible. And
he, yeah, I mean, let's not be mean
I'm
to
sorry,
the cute kid.
I'm sorry, kid, but like, no. his line readings are line readings.
Yeah, and they really they rely on him quite a bit for the aw and, yeah. And for laughs. Yeah, the sex scenes are kind of funny.
Yeah, I thought they were funny.
Everything is kind of funny.
Kind of funny. And this movie is brave enough to let her have the one-night stand with the bartender, and then she later is totally, like, ready to go with Kellan Lutz, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a time that you wouldn't let a female character in a movie do that.
True. She is allowed to be lusty, even if the movie keeps throwing roadblocks in the way of that.
Alonzo, what did you think of her gay assistant?
I mean, you know, it's weird. For a movie with a gay director, this kind of... Dave and I were talking about this on the way home. It's not homophobic. It's homo-stupid. Just because, like, that character is such a... there's so many kind of lame cliches about it. And they do set up a romance there, which is kind of interesting. But and they do sort of find, like, let him be... good at knowing about sports, even though he is a homo. So, like, I guess that's a that's a groundbreaking thing for movies. But then there's, like, these weird, this whole, like, part of that whole wedding revelation, there's this whole weird, like, DL thing that just feels like, really, do we have to do this? Yeah, I wasn't offended. I was just kind of rolling my eyes at it. But there's at least an effort to have inclusion, so I guess that's a good
right.
thing.
He's a stereotype, but then there are elements to his personality that perhaps upend that stereotype.
Yeah.
And he does get to have an unlikely romance, yeah. And that's kind of sweet. Anyway, yeah. I'm saying 5. I am straight down the middle on this.
I said 4.5. I there's a lot that bugged me about it, but it there was, you know, it's not a complete disaster.
I realize it's the tequila talking, but, you know, 7.8. I kind of dug this.
Speaking of the tequila, the most beverage product placement I've ever seen in a movie between Fiji Water, Bud Light, and Johnny Walker Scotch.
And Ciroc.
It is in your face. Oh, and Ciroc
the vodka. Yeah, the drink that the bartender makes for her the first night they meet, he mentions, he like name checks.
And it gets a close-up. The label gets a close-up.
The rose syrup that I make myself blends so well with the Ciroc I just poured for you. Shameless.
Yeah.
All right, so our number is a 5.8. It's a 58% on the tomato meter. Yeah, I'm not sure this needed to exist. But yeah, I guess more Taraji is always better than less Taraji.
Sure.
I enjoy her.
Did you guys like What Women Want very quickly?
I've never seen it.
It's been so long. No. I haven't seen it since it came out. It was so long ago. Matt, did you see
my
it?
Joke from last night?
Remind me.
I see What Women Want every time I look in the mirror.
Yikes.
It's better than Proud Mary. I'll give it that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, far better.
Now time to talk about, as we have been doing, watching television and then talking about it, the latest episode of True Detective. This is episode 5 of this third season of True Detective. It is called If You Have Ghosts. Who wants to describe it?
Well, let's see. I watched it this morning. So we learn in this episode that the junk man has... basically, what happens after that claymore goes off, which is a lot more people die. Stephen Dorff gets shot in the leg, and
a bunch of cops get killed. At least two. Yeah.
Hayes has to shoot the guy in self defense, and then we find out that the kidnapping and murder has been pinned on him because of evidence that was found on the scene
on the junk man.
Yes, there was, they find like a coat in the furnace and the kid's backpack under the porch. 10 years later, Hayes realizes, wait a minute, if that stuff was there when that claymore went off, like, they'd be more burned, like, this is a setup, but, oh, well, what are we going to do about it now? And also in 1990, despite the fact that Hayes wants to keep it a secret that they're looking for Julie, the attorney general, like, puts it on TV and puts Scoot McNairy on TV, and they get a call from a woman basically saying, like, you know, don't let him near me, leave me alone, I want to find where my brother is. They talked to a guy who met a woman who meets Julie's description, who said who referred to herself as a princess, which might tie into the whole fantasy
and
world.
And called herself Mary July,
yes.
And so she's looking for her brother.
Looking for her brother.
Yeah.
Like we left him, he was in peace. Suggesting that the father had something to do with it, but it was cryptic.
Right. Then there's also we see more of the conflict unfolding between Hayes and his wife, where she's constantly like digging for more information. He finds out that he had referred to him as her ex-husband when she was in Salisbury.
with the other cops.
Salinaw, whatever, the other town,
getting information from the cops.
And they have an exquisitely awkward dinner party over at Roland's house.
Yeah, right, in the suburbs.
Right, so Roland is married now, or no, he's about to be married, theoretically, to this woman.
To the woman he met in 1980 at church.
That he was flirting with.
And Lori.
And that dinner party, like, that devolves quickly.
Yeah.
That gets awkward really, really fast. I like this episode.
You have a lovely home after she leaves the table.
I really like this episode a lot because of the last section of it, that last scene where you finally now also see Roland
2015 Roland
as an old man. The makeup work on this show, you guys, is so great, which I had commented on just about when we see Mahershala Ali at this age, but now we see Stephen Dorff at this age as well. It's really beautiful, really seamless, very believable.
And the hair.
Yes. And that section there is so powerful. Just those two actors just sitting side by side on that porch. So much goes on. The power dynamic shifts over and over again until finally they are both left in tears. And it's so subtly powerful the way all that emotion comes to the surface. And it's a great example of this, Nick Pizzolatto just letting his actors act.
I love that you see Roland keep, you know, a couple times references why they haven't talked anymore. And Hayes doesn't remember. Yeah. And you see kind of during that scene, like, Roland kind of lets go of that. And it's...
Yeah.
Well, he finally says, like, if I did something wrong, I'm sorry, but I don't remember what it was.
But Roland makes a decision there. Like, you know, like a lot of people would say, that's not good enough, man. You know, that what a cop-out. But it's like you see Roland's face just say, all right, man, because I am lonely and I have one friend and he hasn't called me in 25 years and now he's here. And I hang out with dogs all day, and I'm going to just accept this.
Yeah,
his discussion with the dogs is great. Yeah, he's a little dog, like.
That rage he shows to Mahershala Ali, to Hayes when he says, "How many of these do you drink a day?" Mm. And you know, I don't have any wife, I don't have any kids, I live here alone, I don't have any friends.
Yeah,
and nobody. And here's what that means: I get to drink whatever I want, however much I want.
It's fascinating to see too. I'm sorry.
No.
How much he has changed in those 25 years, Roland, the Stephen Dorff character, because in the flashbacks, like, he's in control, he's got swagger, he says the right thing, he's ascending through the ranks, like, he's got his shit together. So to see what has happened to him now that he's retired and he's lonely and all by himself, like, it's just such a drastic shift.
There's a nice moment where Hayes says to his son when they get there, like, this can't be the right place because Roland wouldn't live out by himself.
Yeah.
Roland's always around people. Mm-hmm. He's a people person. But clearly what they did, and I think probably less of what they did, because we've learned they appear to have murdered two people, that they, not only what they did, but what they didn't do, which was solve the crime, right?
Yeah.
Clearly their sense is that we screwed this up. And then combined with his whatever Hayes did, which was basically abandon Roland, I think, probably to save his marriage or abandon police work to some extent or whatever he did to save his marriage, we think. That just devastated Roland. Those sort of three events, sort of murdering a couple of people and not solving the case and losing his friend. And Roland then, you know, it suggests...
Or steps away because he can't swallow whatever goes down.
That's right. But it was a facade. His success was, it may have been a mile wide, but it was an inch deep and it cracked and then he fell through.
I will say that things happened in this episode that do bolster the theory that Amelia's the killer.
I feel like this actually gives me more of a clue.
Do you think she did the note?
Oh, absolutely.
After doing the interview?
Because there's phrasing in the book that's exactly like the ransom note. Children should laugh or something like that.
Right. But in the episode, they try and tell you that the mom did the note. That's a new thing we learned in this episode, by the way. The mom died of an OD in a motel room. But yeah, I think, but it could be that she got that in the interview and then she did the note herself. We'll see.
Here's my theory.
I think her conversation with the mom, I mean, I would have to go back and look. I think that that came after. I mean, it certainly came after narratively from the show's point of view. I suppose it could have been earlier. That just feels a little mean to us to have now turned it around and have had her conversation come before that notoriety.
So you think the flashbacks are in chronological order?
I think that in the given
within
episode,
their own timelines,
within their own timelines, that feels a little sneaky to cheat inside the timeline.
Okay.
I think this episode gives evidence that Amelia is not involved as the killer.
Interesting.
I think that the mom,
Mamie Gummer, daughter of Meryl.
So I think because she's been fooling around on Scoot McNairy so much, I think that the daughter, Julie, is not actually
Scoot McNairy's kid.
Oh.
Right? Whereas the boy was. And I think she was going to leave with her daughter and leave his son behind, which was also hers. But I think she's going to take the daughter and run off with some other guy who was there part of it. And somebody else killed Will. And maybe it's like, maybe it's Hoyt, the guy who runs the chicken farm or the chicken processing plant.
Well, we still don't know who put the hole in the closet. And you know, the cousin is the one whose skeleton they found in the quarry, and so I think
that Hayes and Roland killed the cousin and killed the other cop.
They killed the cousin.
Right.
And they killed
we don't
the
know
other
why
cop.
They did that.
They
but
killed
I
the
think...
cop who's missing. Who we think we're going to learn. I think we're going to learn. Planted the backpack
and killed the Native American junkyard guy.
Well, that
was suicide by cop. Yes,
and we never found out about what happened to the
guy in the trunk.
We never found what happened to the guy in the trunk yet.
What I'm really admiring about
still in the trunk
this season is I like Pizzolatto. I think if you're a writer and you want to study like how to dole out information in dribs and drabs at interesting places, that's what the show is doing exceptionally well. Like the fact that it took us until episode 5 to find out who got the junkyard Woodard.
I think
the fact that Woodard gets saddled with being the kidnapper and the murderer, like that was a late reveal.
Yeah.
You know?
So like after leading us to believe that we were looking at a show sort of inspired, set in the Ozarks, that it was a West Memphis 3. It's not a West Memphis 3. That was a really interesting scene to learn that kid.
The scene with the teenager who's now older,
right?
Getting,
who says
Hayes, that
we
was
saw Will
scene.
Looking for his sister. Right, like somebody else took the daughter
already. Right,
Took Julie, and then Will gets killed later.
But beyond plot wise, like the scene of him confronting Hayes, but like, oh, you're not dealing with a scared teenage boy, or trying to make me piss my pants again. That was an amazing scene.
Yeah, and good because this sort of punk nose kid who was a bully and you know wanted to steal the kid's bike and was uncooperative has turned into an unpleasant asshole of a adult, while also making a totally salient, righteous point that Hayes had all the power and abused that power
then,
when he was questioning.
And then
Hayes'
follow up scene in the car where he like won't let it go.
And in the thing after the show on if you watch it online, Pizzolatto said, you know, essentially I'm paraphrasing, but you know that he knew that last scene between Roland and Hayes and Wayne was good. Right, but then he was like, but man, when those guys then did it, and you're like, wow, that is so much better than what I wrote.
That's available, too, on HBO, if you watch it on demand on HBO.
That's what I meant, on demand.
All that stuff. Yeah. It definitely does reward you for paying attention, though, you know, the little drips and drabs of info. Anyway, so it's getting better. It's picking up steam. We just did episode 5. There are only 3 more left.
Yep. I think this is going to do really – I hope that this is a new chapter of Stephen Dorff's career because he's killing it.
He's so good.
Yeah. Oh, and we, just quickly, I know that we got to wrap it up, but that just those 2 lines from when Scoot McNairy says, like, you know, pleading when he realizes sort of what's happened. He's like, oh, my God, is that my daughter's voice? And he thinks it's good, and then he realizes they're about to focus their attention on him, and he's like, Lieutenant West, Roland.
Right.
We're out of the scene.
We were friends.
Yeah, like what's happening?
He can't,
man, I've fixed my life and I've already had these terrible tragedy happen to me and now you're about to tell me I killed these people? I killed my children? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and in that call, like when Julie's saying, like, the man who says he's my father, like she knows that that Scoot McNairy's not her dad.
That's right.
None of that even occurred to me. Wow. Mind blown. Yeah. We've got one more little review for you. It's just me and Alonzo now.
It's a podcast exclusive.
It's a podcast exclusive. Ben and Matt have left, and they have not seen Everybody Knows.
Yes.
Everybody knows.
Wait, which one are you doing?
I'm doing the Concrete Blonde one.
Oh, because it's, you know, it's also a Leonard Cohen song.
I think it was primarily a Leonard Cohen song, and Concrete Blonde did a cover of it.
Okay.
I think that's how I knew it first. Gotcha. Anyway, pero en español, todos lo saben.
Yes.
So this is a really weird mishmash of stuff. It's an Asghar Farhadi film.
Right.
Set in Spain.
Right.
Starring Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem, but not as a married couple, as they are in real life.
Correct.
But she lives, her character lives in Argentina with Ricardo Darín, who is Argentinian. Anyway,
right.
So I'm going to try to explain this to you, but there's a whole lot of stuff going on in this movie here. So Penelope Cruz plays a woman named Laura, who goes back to her small town, it's like a village outside of Madrid, right?
It's, I think a little more, a little further north.
Is
but
it?
Yeah,
it's, okay. It's in Spain. It's a village in Spain where she has not lived for a while. She comes back with her teenage daughter and young son for the wedding of her younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a lot of history in this place, a lot of family in this place. It's the kind of place, there's a really rich sense of place in this town with the locals kind of hanging out their windows and spying on people or sitting outside at the cafe tables and everyone's watching what everyone else is doing and everyone's into everybody else's business.
Yeah, her father used to own like pretty much all the lands and doesn't anymore but still sort of swans about as if he does, and so there's a lot of long-seated resentments. And
yeah, and so I guess when she was young, she was in love with Javier Bardem, who has stayed there and now runs the estate, the vineyard, which previously was Penelope Cruz's dad's land,
right,
the family's land. She has come back without her husband, we understand early on. He could not make it because of some kind of work thing.
Mm.
And the wedding is joyous, and it's a lot of fun and a lot of drinking and a lot of dancing. And they've got people videoing it for them for posterity using drones and stuff. So it's an old fashioned setting, but with like newfangled technology that will become relevant later on. And somehow in the middle of this, her daughter disappears.
Right.
And so it becomes a totally different kind of movie about halfway in.
Yeah, yeah. You go into this kind of expecting it's this sort of like Altman meets Almodovar thing of, you know, who are the cousins and who are the in-laws and what are the sort of family secrets and what is it about this town where, like, there's a line that somebody says that, like, that basically, for the women, if they want to be successful, they have to marry somebody from somewhere else, you know, whether it's Argentina or Madrid or, you know, something like that. And then, yeah, suddenly it becomes this thing of like, oh, God, my child is missing and what happened, and trying to sort of put together the clues and, you know, like using the drone footage to try and figure out when she left and why. And, you know, is there a ransom demand and all of the, you know, and who's behind it? Yeah, it juggles tones very interestingly. And for a Farhadi film, you know, who he previously did, he won Oscars for A Separation and The Salesman. This is, it feels a lot more like a genre film because it's always about the characters and they're always first and foremost, it does sort of become a procedural after a while because you do have to sort of, they do have to find this girl, you know.
The thing that makes it a Farhadi film is the notion of the secrets and the resentments that are bubbling beneath the surface here, you know, and how you never truly know the people that you think you know that you have trusted your life with. And that's been a thread throughout, you know, his best known films. And that certainly exists here as well. And there are secrets and that tension does build. But it doesn't work for me when it is the procedural at all. It becomes a different film and not as interesting a one, a more of a mundane one as far as being a whodunit.
I mean, yes, relatively speaking, the crime part is less interesting than the rest of it. But I think that so much of the crime part is informed by what we've learned in the first half of the film and about this village and how people feel about Penelope Cruz's family and who Penelope Cruz was involved with in the past and what relevance that might have to the present, you know, the relationship that she and her husband have. He winds up showing up from Argentina, you know, to help out with the search. And, you know, we learn things about him and their relationship that we didn't know before. And so, I don't feel like it goes off the rails by any means, because I feel like whatever happens in the second half, as much as it does feel like a somewhat more familiar find the missing person story, it does still feel like it's built upon the foundation that the movie sets up.
And Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem are endlessly watchable.
Oh,
you know, individually and together, of course, there is sort of that inescapable kind of fascination of watching people who are married in real life,
sure,
you know, play on screen together. But individually, even when they're not together, they're both so good.
And she has this arc where, you know, she starts off and she's like so vibrant and full of life and, oh, my homecoming and my sister's wedding. And then just the like emotional devastation of having her daughter go missing and how it's wrenching to watch. I mean, she really taps into this sense of like what a mother would go through under those circumstances that I think, you know, she doesn't get licensed to do in a lot of movies. And so she really, it kind of reminded me of somebody like going back to like Anna Magnani, you know, like a lot of times her best performances will call up that kind of earthy energy, you know, like Volver, you know, I think has a lot of that in it as well. But yeah, I was impressed with the depths of her angst in this movie.
Yeah, I was thinking of Volver a lot in this as well. And also Vicky Cristina Barcelona in like the showiness of it, the bigness of it. And then Javier Bardem as well has his own kind of arc, because at the beginning, he's very much in command, you know, he's in charge of all the men in the fields.
And, yeah, he's like the foreman.
Right, he runs the place with great swagger and great charisma.
And he and his wife have a real kind of sexy chemistry, the woman who plays his wife in the film.
Yeah, and then that changes as the film goes along, too. Yeah, I kept wanting to like it more, you know, like the pieces are there, but the shift that it makes made it increasingly uninteresting,
sure,
to me, at least. It's also very long. It's like 2 hours and 15 minutes long, and I'm not sure.
I didn't feel so much. No, I kept engaged with it. I think it's probably the kind of movie where you're better off not going in expecting the new Oscar Farhadi, you know, because like he's really, if you've been following his career, I think he's really kind of raised the bar as to what we think about his work. And, you know, this is like, I think this one's better than the one that he made after a separation that had
The Past.
Yeah. With Berenice Bejo, that one.
I think that was The Past. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think that one was that great, but like, I think this one's better than that. It's maybe not up to Salesman or a Separation,
right,
but it's still pretty dang good. And it's worth seeing certainly for those two lead performances.
Right. So I'm saying 5.8.
What did I say?
You said 7.
7,
do you want to keep your 7?
I do.
All right. So our number is 6.4. It is at 63% on the tomato meter. And this might just be opening in New York and LA this week. But since Alonzo and I both saw it, we wanted to get to it, of course.
Yes.
I'm guessing that you're not reading the subtitles at all while you're watching it.
You know, it's nice to have them there. I mean, I mostly understood it. But, you know, like, I have seen Spanish films without subtitles. And I almost have to, like, keep one ear cocked at the screen. You know, my Spanish is pretty good, but like not, you know, native level.
And this is Spanish.
Yes. You know, definitely there are some turns of phrases that the subtitles missed. And I'm like, oh, you know, that kind of thing, but whatever.
I understood that joke. All right. So it's a 6.4 from us. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. And next week we've got Alita Battle Angel.
Yes.
We're going to play catch up with High Flying Bird, which Alonzo and I saw, and we really want the other guys to see as well. It's so good. It's on Netflix. So if you guys want to watch that over the weekend, come back next week and listen to our discussion of that.
And Matt and I will catch up on Lego Movie 2.
There's Lego Movie 2. We'll do a little bit more on that. There is Happy Death Day to You.
Mm-hmm.
And is next week Valentine's Day? Oh, yeah. Isn't it Romantic is next week?
Oh, yes.
There's a weird release schedule where some stuff is coming out on the 13th. Some on the 14th, some on the 15th.
Yeah.
So we'll do Isn't It Romantic as well, which looks really cute. And I'm hoping it's not the kind of situation where all the best stuff is in the trailer.
Indeed. Although I was watching, the ad came on TV and Dave goes, is this another movie about a plus size woman who hits her head?
So we'll see how that rolls out.
Well, Taraji P. Henson hits her head and wacky things happen. So it's the time for high concept comedies.
I was thinking about Amy Schumer in I Feel Pretty.
Oh, right. Yeah. So we have, it is the time for high concept comedies. So thank you for listening. Alonzo, tell everyone where they can find us.
Hey, we're at BeFast All Day on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can subscribe to this podcast in all the places where podcasts live. We're on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review or leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify, Google Play, Podbean, CastBox, you name it. We're out there.
You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Bye.